You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Bobby Osinski. Bobby, welcome
back.
Hi, Mike.
It's good to see you, man.
Thank you kindly.
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon. Scott!
Hey! Good morning, Mike.
It's good to see you. Next to him, we've got the one and only Forrest Robinson. Forrest!
See now, Mike.
Forrest, it's good to see you, bro.
Good to see you. I haven't seen y'all since the earth was cooling. Good to see y'all.
Next to Forrest, we've got our good friend Hez. Hez!
Hey, everybody.
About it. And next to him, we've got Bobby Summerfield. Bobby.
Hello, Mike.
And finally, over here on my left, we've got the Iron Man of the Audio Nowcast, Rob Arbiteer.
Hello there, Mike.
Rob, show 109. Rob.
Is it really?
109.
Wow. And it's Rob's 110th.
Yeah, the time I showed up and none of you were here.
And joining us today, we have the honor and privilege of having our good friend Patrick Leonard back with us. Patrick.
Hello. Hello.
All right, Patrick. Yay.
Thank you.
Patrick.
My honor.
And we have a lot to talk about. There's a ton of things that I want to cover. But first of all, before we even dig into everything, Forrest, it's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Were you out? Were you playing out and about?
Yeah, I had some shows with Angelique Kidjo.
He was in jail. Come on, tell
us. All right, man. Yeah, after the show.
Why is he sitting in an orange suit? You can't see it on the podcast.
Never mind these numbers. That's just my address.
Well, that's good. It's good because I know it's summertime and the season and a lot of gigs going on out there. So when I mention it, I'm totally envious of you going out there and playing live.
It still exists, believe it or not.
People live? With real people?
Outside of this country, but
yeah, that's true. Well, hey, today we're going to talk about a couple things, and we're going to talk about, copyright for one. We'll talk about the fact that now, after 35 years, the provision kicks in where you can petition to get your songs back. But also, we're going to talk about the fact that the IRAA is going to be fighting that, and they're going to be saying that you're basically were work for hire.
Yeah, I thought they were our friends.
Well, and that's what.
No, Bobby O, no.
But you know what?
Keep your friends close.
let's just dig in on that, and I'm gonna refer to Bobby Osinski, and Bobby, share us a little clarity on the whole copyright and petitioning and the whole thing that came up.
Okay, first of all, the RIAA is not your friend as an artist because it's a record label industry association. So they care about the record labels. They don't much care about the people that work for them or work with them. The reason why the RIAA is fighting this is because it's less income for the record labels, because people that had signed originally with record labels 35 and more years ago they pretty much had to sign a publishing deal with that record label's publishing company. So that's the big problem right now. Since if you signed a publishing deal way back when, now 35 years later you can get it back. You can get your publishing back. Well, obviously that hurts the bottom line of the record label.
Right.
So that's a big deal. But there's some stipulations, though. It's not quite as cut and dried as it seems. First of all, if you stipulate, 2013 is actually when, January 1st, 2013 is when everything reverts back. But it only reverts back if 2 years prior to that you petition for it.
Oh, gosh. Mm.
So, in other words, if you wait until January 1st, 2013, you can't get it back until 2015. Plus, you have a 5-year window to petition. If you don't petition in that 5 years, you lose that ability forever and ever.
Oh, goodness.
So, there's all these stipulations that happen. And unless you have an attorney that's looking out for you, you may not actually make this happen. Now, that being said, all the major writers have done this already. Bob Dylan has done it. Bruce Springsteen has done it. not all the major writers, but a lot of them.
Right. One
of the big artists that have done
two.
It. Yeah, right. Two, right. Big two, though.
But so, does it override what was in the original record deal? I mean, or the original publishing deal?
Yeah.
Does it just say that contract is then no longer valid?
No, it's not the contract. It's the publishing.
It's the ownership.
It's the ownership.
Yeah, it's the ownership.
Right. So, so after 35 years, the publishing goes back to the composer?
It can if you petition for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
It can.
That's a lot of money.
It could be, yeah. And obviously, if you're a writer, you want that back.
I'm surprised people aren't brokering, representing artists to say, look, I'll represent you. We'll get all of this catalog back, but I want a piece of this.
I'm sure they are.
Because you got to remember that there's somebody that can say, I can make this easy for you for a percentage.
Yeah, because a small writer may not be able to.
But catalogs, in other words, huge catalogs of artists or their estates.
Or how about just the record labels themselves putting deals together with the artists?
I'm saying,
making it easy for them to get their control of the music back, but saying, hey, we'll make it easy for you to get to control your music back, but, you know, why don't you give us, you know, 10% or whatever, just so they can keep the...
too greedy.
Well, no, what they're trying to do is they're trying to just enter into, get the artist to enter into a new publishing agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of it being a 50-50 deal or,
right,
or whatever, they're saying, okay, so guess what? We'll only take 25 or how about 10?
Right, exactly.
Just so they can administrate it and get some money coming in,
right,
rather than nothing.
Which might actually be worth it.
Yeah.
At that point.
Oh, yeah.
Am I correct in that it's 35 years?
It has, yes.
It's 35 years in, right?
Yeah.
So that's when it becomes available.
Yeah.
What about for artists now who, say, like, sign with labels, if there actually is such a thing? Or I guess the other thing, God, as soon as I said that, I started thinking about how the fact that the people that seem to be getting signed are more like stars and personalities more so than... I mean, some artists are getting signed, but it still seems like more personalities.
Well, but you're also talking about if it's 35-year-old music, you know whether it was a hit or valuable or not. Anybody who's starting out now, you own your own publishing because you don't have a deal. So, you know, if you make that decision now, it's a very different thing that's going through the mind of someone who had music from 35 years ago because they're trying to get something back that they already know the value of. If you have a new catalog... I mean, a lot of people today are doing it themselves and not even having a publishing deal. And if they get a publishing deal, the publisher is getting them connections and you know, usage that they could never get on their own most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, aren't the deals vastly different nowadays, you know, not even nowadays, the last 10 years than they were, let's say, 35 years ago? I mean, you...
Well, it's a different form of a 360 deal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And essentially, back then, their 360 deal was all we care about is the publishing and selling records. They didn't much care about anything else. Now, of course, there's not enough money in that, so they care about everything that an artist makes, and that's why they want, you know, those additional income streams.
They do. They want merchandising and stuff.
Oh, yeah, right. Merchandising and touring.
Yeah, they do.
I'm surprised companies like CAA and companies like that don't... Because, like, a friend of mine is in charge of all of the... toys or paraphernalia that come out bearing your resemblance or anything that you do. So whether it be sports, rock, actors, whatever, anything, you know, tertiary markets, and you would think they would sit there and say, hey, look, we'll manage your catalog. You know, you buy it.
Oh, they would say that company, yeah.
Yeah, because then they can sell it to TV, they can sell it to games, they can sell it to movies.
But that's what the record label says. The record label says, okay, we will do that deal for you. So they may use those same people, but it's through the record label. That's the way that's working.
Mm.
Now, let me ask you a question. So we know how it's working with the 35 years. Now, how successful do you think the RIAA is going to be in fighting some of these things and trying to label some of these writers work for hire as opposed to having their own individual license and right to that particular song? Because according to the way I read it, is the IRA saying, hey, listen, you're on our label and we were paying for everything and you were working for us and you're basically a work for hire at that time.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to fly in the long run. And the RIAA recently has actually suffered a number of defeats, serious defeats, actually. So if precedent maintains, they're not going to win this one either. The only thing they have going for them is pockets full of money. So they have really good attorneys, and they can, you know, just make it really difficult.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the contracts, you're not work for hire when you sign a record deal. You can't be, right?
It's against the law, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially 35 years ago. I mean, I think this doesn't impact me. It doesn't impact many people that I know, some people that I know.
Right.
It would impact that material from that time. But the individual songs from those periods, the money that's being generated from them now, my guess is, isn't on an individual basis enough to really get your panties in a twist about. It's the collective impact that those catalogs support from 35 years ago. So the thing to do is to sort of, for me, just because I knew about this, but I don't have to. I'm not paying a lot of attention to these things. Shame on me, but I don't. but if you contextualize it and you think of who was writing then and who was doing the stuff 35 years ago, and you put that list together, which you could just go online and type in a date and you'd find it pretty quick.
Right.
Who were the bands? Who was writing the music? And most of the bands were writing their own songs at the time. They weren't, there weren't writers as much as artists. And if you take Neil Young and you take Zeppelin and you pull all of their money that the companies may or may not have had publishing in, no one ever got the publishing that I did. But I was in a different, the period that I was writing in, the main body of work that I did, people weren't getting publishing, especially not from just a writer who was a producer. They might ask the artist for it, but they weren't as desperate for it because they were making more money off record sales. Mm-hmm. So, but in those days, they did take the publishing. Right. It was par for the course. And I wouldn't know what those deals are like, but my guess is if you did the math, you'd find that the impact, that what's really going to be impacted is sort of the bottom line of the labels that had this stuff as catalog. And they just put it in the back and they just left it there. And there's a certain amount of income that comes in that goes, well, we can get much nicer chairs for the office. That money's going to be gone.
Yeah.
They still own the recordings. So they still own
They
still own the recordings of the era, so they still own the artist's recordings.
The masters.
Well, the masters, yeah.
Yeah.
But they don't own the publishing.
The mechanical income, they have the master, but every time it gets played, they don't get paid anymore.
Well, other than, they don't get the publisher share.
No, do not get that, and that's huge. So,
but you're right about the collective income and how it reflects on the bottom line of the record label.
Yeah, that's really what this is about.
And it's, when you look at EMI,
as an individual, it doesn't concern any of us really.
Sure.
And that even somebody like Bob Dylan, obviously, who wrote everything.
Yeah.
In those days, that's just him. He was writing everything.
Right.
He's going to have a huge
made it a lot easier.
Yeah.
But when you look at EMI,
what do? We need songs.
Go to that guy
Dylan's.
Yeah. When you look at EMI, who's up for sale, that makes a big difference.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think at this point, if we all threw some money on this table, we could buy
EMI. Yeah.
Well, no, actually, the price is going up and up and up. It's $1 billion more than they expected already.
Wow.
And they're in the third round of bids, and no one expected it to go past the first one. So it's actually, and I don't know why.
I don't know why either.
But it's going up and up. There's some thought that it has to do with the catalog more than anything. And because, they get the big five. The Beatles, Bob Seger, believe it or not, Pink Floyd. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who the other two were. But
Floyd Lessons is expensive. To put Pink Floyd in on movies or TV,
yeah, sure.
That's why you don't hear it at all.
Yeah, right.
Because it's not just expensive; it's also they won't do it.
Because I know when I did American Beauty, we were trying to get some Pink Floyd music, and it was $1 million just for just that. Like, and they just went, yeah, okay, next song.
You know what? One sort of unintended consequence of this battle that's going on, sounds good to call it a battle, but this discussion that's going on about copyrights is that this is going to be a public enough discussion that a lot of young writers are going to be sort of made aware of how important it is not to just sign your copyrights away so easily. And so it actually could have a good impact in that regard, because they're going to see, why are all these old guys fighting to get their stuff back? Maybe there's some value here. And that's a healthy thing, because for a long time, I mean, you talk to any new artist, they just... I want to sign a deal. Yeah. I need a deal. They have no idea what it means.
That hasn't changed. I mean, those bands.
But this could help that.
Yes,
a little bit.
Yeah, the industry to make money is changed a little.
But at least if you realize that a copyright's actually a really valuable thing, yeah. That a label would have you sign away in a heartbeat,
right.
And everybody used to very
real early. Estate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
So that might be.
Kid, I make you a star.
I don't think I mentioned this last time, or maybe I did. But when I worked for Steve Miller, I remember asking him once. I said, "You know, Steve, you've done really well. Good for you, obviously." And he said, "Yeah, because of he had a clause for 20 years, so he got his copyrights back." From EMI, like, and that was 10 years ago. So wow. he was he's a smart guy. He was ahead of the game.
Savvy.
Wow.
Very savvy.
Well, you know, one thing about copyright too is it's, you know, copyright not only in music but in a lot of different creative areas is just it's.
It's calling you.
I know. Hello. No, but it's really a. Just a really tumultuous time in the whole copyright era, because, you know, with patents and the fact that every time, you know, Mickey Mouse comes up for to go into public domain, it seems like, you know, that copyright gets extended, and it's all of this is just, it's really interesting to see how it's all going to play out, how it's all going to wind up.
Well, everything that I've been involved in for years and continue to be involved in is all about the ownership of intellectual property.
Right.
That's it. Like, everything spins around that.
Mm-hmm. And it seems, you know, like it's such everything. A cut and dry thing, but it's really not.
No, it's
because
not
you get people who start dividing up their intellectual properties, and you get people who get percentages.
More and more now with the rest of the world.
But, you know, there's two mind things right now in entertainment. There's, for lack of a better word, let's call it Hollywood entertainment, which is kind of the status quo of the way businesses are run. And then there's Silicon Valley entertainment. And they're starting to, because they're, the way they make things, when they make, whether it's video games or animation, there's assets coming in from everywhere, there's visual assets. And a lot of times when we deal with these people, it's not as much as they want to own it because they think they can make money from it. They want to own it so they don't have to be liable for it.
Right.
So they own it, it's work for hire, give it to me, and I never have to worry about screwing up ever again. If this ever goes in the public domain, you can't sue us. We're EA, we're Activision, we're, you know, one of the big electronics. We're Apple.
Right.
And they just want it easy and not be exposed. Because we deal with that a lot. Because we sell assets all the time to clients.
Right.
So what we do is we don't sell it. We actually license it for perpetuity.
Right. That's the way to do it. I have a music library, the same sort of
yeah.
thing. They just want to be able to control it as well. They want to make a decision.
And then what if we somebody... do is, you know, we license it for that project. So if they ever go outside that project, they have to call us again. In other words, so if you have a title and a franchise,
right.
and we create something for it, in perpetuity, as long as you want... for the name of that franchise. But what we don't want them to do ever is to create a library. Because if they do that, then all of a sudden we start going out of business.
Yeah.
So everything is unique. So you come up with a new title, guess what?
But, you know, even taking that model and on a very small scale, how it can apply to people who may be listening to the podcast, I have a friend of mine
nobody's
who
listening,
was...
don't worry.
Yeah, to the four people that are listening. I have a friend of mine who's a graphic artist, and he designed a brochure for a company, and the company beat him up for the brochure. And he said, and he's going, you know, I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything, but here's what's going to happen. I'm going to design this brochure for you guys, and you guys are going to love it because I do really good work. And then you're going to come back to me in 2 weeks, and you're going to say, let me have the Photoshop file, because then what's going to end up happening is I'm going to give you the Photoshop file, and you're going to take that Photoshop file, and you're going to put it on the brochure, and you're going to do a second version. You're going to put it on your letterhead. You're going to put it on your website, and you're going to spread it all around. And so... that's why I charge what I charge. And the guy's going, no, we're not going to do it. He goes, okay. So he put his price down. It wasn't 2 weeks. It was 3 weeks later. They started asking him for the file. And then since he was a friend of mine and I knew both sides because I put them together, they started asking me to ask him for the file. And I told him, I said, I can't do that. That's how he, you know, why don't you just have him? He did such a great job on the brochure. Why don't you just have him design, you know, the web thing or design the press release or whatever you're doing? And on a small scale, that's kind of how the whole, you know, this whole copyright and managing your intellectual property, because you want to be able to take what you created and maintain control, because people will always try to screw you.
They always say content is king. You know, everybody always says content is king, but it's true.
It is.
The only currency in the artistic world is artistic content.
Right. Well, the other part of that is distribution is king, because you can have all the content in the world. Nobody if you don't it. Get it out there,
right?
No one sees it. So,
well, but I mean, it's a lot easier.
But the distributors usually say that.
Yeah, of course.
But if you think about it, distribution is getting way cheaper than it's ever been, because you're a mouse click away from reaching the world.
And almost with the internet now, it's going to be marketing. Because distribution is easy, but now how do we get you out of the clutter, all that noise on the internet? How do we have you stand apart?
The thing is, it happens for very few artists each year, but if you happen to become the pet project of a label, and they happen to decide that they want to make you the next big thing, they're going to throw resources and use connections for you that, you know, you can't do for yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't just immediately say, I got to get my stuff back because no one knows how to do it better than me. Yeah. You know, if you get your... This doesn't really hold true for these, you know, 35-plus-year-old copyrights. But for anybody now, you know, owning your content is great, but if no one ever gets to hear it, what's the point? You do have to think about, how do I get it out there? You try to give away as little as possible, obviously, but you have to be partnered up with someone who can get your content heard the way it needs to be heard.
You got to be flexible. There's some flexibility.
Well, a lot of times, if you're not greedy, you can do a lot better.
Right. A friend of mine on the video game side... which I thought was pretty brilliant. Tommy Tallarico put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a smart little thing. What he would do is he would sit there and say, look, I own the publishing for a song that I did some video game, and they went like, yeah, whatever, you know. No one's going to buy the album. So I said, you know what? I'll give you a cut of, let's say, 25%. You don't have to do anything. I'll publish it. And they're like, great. So suddenly they give the rights out. All of a sudden, like, you look at Call of Duty right now, it's actually on the list. People are actually buying the soundtrack. Some of these sounds, I mean, they're starting to really pick up and get a following.
Halo's a good example.
I mean, there's a lot of good stuff. And it's interesting that sometimes the companies may not even think about, you know, publishing an ancillary piece of a game out of context. But if you make an incentive, there's an upside. They'll be more than happy to work with you on it.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely have to be creative in how you're doing your licensing and your publishing. And actually, speaking of licensing, Bobby, you weren't here, but the last couple of podcasts, I talked a little bit about Spotify, because I'm what do you call a user of Spotify?
Huge fan.
Fanboy.
Yeah, fanboy.
A Spotifyer.
If you Spotify, you're a spot. Right?
But the one part that sits with me, where I'm the most uneasy about, is the artists. You know, I just can't see how they're going to be making money off this thing. And basically, you answered that question pretty good by saying they're not.
Well, they're making a streaming royalty, and the streaming royalty is 0.00102.
Oh God, help us!
Sorry. So it's a tenth of a cent for every stream. Now it's going up.
Right.
Next year it's going to be 0.0011, and the year after that it's going to go up a little more.
Hey, it's in the right direction,
but it's a fraction of a cent. It's not that much. So therein lies the problem.
Yeah, but don't you think?
But it's the same for Pandora. It's the same for any stream that you're getting. The difference is it's a slightly higher rate if it's from a like an online broadcaster. If it's from Kiss FM, for instance, online, you get, it's not quite double, but it's. You know, somewhat more. It's still nothing when it's all said and done.
How do you measure a stream? Is it once you click on it, or does it have to play it to the end? I mean, because some people, you know, you listen to a song, if you don't want to hear the whole thing,
No, there's actually two different rates. There's a rate if you listen, and I don't know where it cuts off. I think it's 30 seconds. But you get... Even less than that, obviously. For partial. And then if it goes beyond that amount, whatever it is, then you get your full rate of 0.00102.
Does the artist get that, or is that the record label that gets that, or does the songwriter get any of that? I mean, where does
that... Or is that like the whole royalty
that
gets
the whole
divided
thing?
Up?
That's
full,
publishing.
It's all the performance royalty.
Yeah.
Publishing. So what was the equivalent, like if you got airplay for a single on a major radio station? Do you know what that was at its peak?
Well, it's hard to say because it's all based on a formula that BMI or ASCAP comes up with. So what they do is every, I don't know,
pour the money together.
2 or 3 years, you know, whenever they do it, they go to the broadcasters and they say to the NAB, basically, and they say, okay, what we want is $8 billion a year.
For the whole catalog, right?
Yeah, and it's a blanket license. And then what happens is they have a formula that it's based on the amount of plays, and the way they figure it out is they look at the logs, they listen, and they also have a computer program that kind of figures all this out. And there's an algorithm that then says, okay, Paul McCartney was yesterday was played
just yesterday
400,000 times, so that means that you can get this much money, but whatever, Joe Blow's song was only played 3 times, so that's worth this much.
It's all percentages of the pie, isn't it?
And it's a percentage of the pie, but it changes. It's a moving target.
Depends on how many times you get played.
Well, it does, but it also depends on when during the survey period. So, for instance, if you're not played a lot when they're surveying it, or if you're played a lot when they're surveying it, and not played when you're surveying it, when they're in the middle of it, then all of a sudden you're not going to get as much money than as if you were during a survey period.
Yeah.
The other thing is both ASCAP and BMI do it differently. Yeah. How they divide the pie. And anybody who's ever been a co-writer, if you're a BMI writer and you have a co-writer, it's ASCAP, and vice versa.
That's a terrible thing, by the way.
It is, but when you get your check and you compare it, you go, holy shit.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's higher and sometimes it's lower, and nobody can figure out why. Mm-hmm. And it also depends where it's played a lot. If it's played on the radio, for instance, ASCAP is usually higher, but if it's on television, for instance, or a movie, BMI is higher. So, it's all moving target.
So depressing.
Yeah.
Well, but the thing is also, in those days, though,
I could make it so much worse.
And it was still, but you were still making an order of magnitude more than you're making now.
Oh, yeah. I think now with the digital age, before it was hard because it was hard to keep track of everything. But now, you could be exact. I mean,
it's something. I my main income is royalties. That's all I make. That's my main income.
Yeah.
And my slippage is about 34%. That's with ASCAP. I mean, I've got a couple
34%
thousand.
34% error rate?
Error rate. I got a couple of thousand. I've got 2,700 tracks, so it's a lot. But when I go to ASCAP, they send me a sheet each quarter, and I go through it. My buddy, and I'll tell you this, my buddy, I was a co-writer on, he's like, dude, we got 17K for this use. I said, great. I said, let me have a look through that. And I don't see any 17K on this quarter. He's like, oh? So I'm like, so he and I were 50-50 writer. They made a mistake and put him down as 100% writer. So the error is crazy.
Yeah,
the slippage is crazy.
We've had that too.
Yeah, misreporting, tons.
Yeah.
Scary stuff.
Patrick, were you
saying? I'm sure you know. No. I ain't going there.
Sound like a smart move.
Yeah. The room grew strangely quiet.
But let me ask a bigger question.
A little bit.
Okay, go there.
The way it's always figured for me, and I think for everybody, is that because people fight over 0.12 or 1.3, or they fight over it, and. A long time ago, I figured out that the songs that I was writing, my catalog is similar to yours, about 2,800 pieces in it. That of the 2,800, 15 of them were going to put my kids through college, and the rest weren't going to do anything at all, nothing. And so the 1 penny or 1.5 pennies or 3 pennies was not worth fighting about, because if it wasn't a massive hit, you couldn't buy a steering wheel cover. If it was a massive hit, you could buy a Bentley. And there was no in between. Right. So many years ago, I just dismissed it. And any time I've checked, and any time I've looked, and any time I've paid really close attention, the rules have not changed one bit. So the idea that just because you have content, you can earn a living from it is wrong, especially now. And I don't even know what the rules are now, because I don't play the game anymore. But that's how it was for me. That of all of the stuff, 10 songs paid for everything. And when I sold the catalog, which I did, the publisher share, which I finally sold it because it was diminishing so rapidly that even with the people that tried to talk me out of it for years when I went, too bad you talked me out of this 5 years ago. Look what's happened. And you just watch it going like this. And you think, well, what could rescue this? The answer is, oh, nothing. So let's stop this now. Let's stop the bleeding now.
Unless you get a nice cover when you're about 70, though. and China's online, and they've sold about 27 million copies.
They make it the national anthem.
and they
twitch on it. And you don't have to audit them to get them to pay. But when that went down, it held true that it's, you know, it's 15 songs that they paid for.
Wow.
And the rest of it is just, it's this stuff. And you can get someone out there working, you get a license and they work, and you go, okay, someone says, I'd like to do this for you. I say, great, let's do it. We'll start a little relationship. And they say, well, here's what I need. I need to get this amount per month to do this work. And you go, okay, here you go. And then you go, what's the income? And they go, well, it's about a quarter of what you're paying me to do this.
Oh, wow.
2,500 songs. It's like, you know, and you could land something where it's a theme to a TV show or something, and that could happen. But that's darts.
Yeah,
that's
it,
you know what I mean? It's like, I like something with a little more accuracy than that.
Right.
And also, I don't think that it's a good place to put your energy. Just for me, I'm happier just trying to play something I can't play than, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I'm just staying with the music rather than...
That's why I'm happy, because I can't play anything. I'm a perfect
I'm getting closer by the day.
Although I think, really, we realize now the brass ring is to hold out for that national anthem spot. I never even thought of that. Right. That's like perfect.
Write the national anthem.
Write the national anthem. The next national anthem.
Or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yeah. That would work.
Yeah, there you go. White Christmas, yeah.
It's the only song the guy wrote.
Is it really?
Is it really?
It's the only song he wrote.
When it's more than 35 years ago, so...
Yeah, he wrote a long time ago, but it was for like his daughter, for like a Christmas present for his daughter.
Really?
Skokie, Illinois, and he wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in 1938 or something like that.
Did he make any money himself on it?
Recorded it on a steam-powered recorder.
Did he make anything on that?
Yeah, he has a big house in the Chicago suburbs.
You guys make me wonder how much Barry Manilow has made from like the genius... things he's done, like Nabisco and Oreo.
No, they're all buyouts. I just read something the other day about that.
They're
all buyouts.
I wrote a bunch of commercials. I wrote a bunch of commercials that you've all had crammed down your throat in the early 80s, and you get paid out. You don't know.
You come into the session, they say, bend over, thank you.
Yeah, I remember when they asked ASCAP.
This is realism 101, Mike.
So we should get ASCAP, and they're like...
You get paid well, but that's it. You're done.
That's it.
You know what? You got to get vocals on it. That's what you
got to
get.
You got the F of M.
You know what, though? With those jobs, and I'm the poster child for that.
Uh-oh.
Hot pockets.
After these messages.
The truth is...
They're doing a new campaign. I saw it the other day.
Oh, I know. They're still using it. Hot pockets.
That's you?
That's me.
Lord have mercy. I know.
We got paid for it, but not that much. But the thing is... A lot of times, if you're not willing to do those jobs as a buyout, the next guy in line is. So, it's, and for us, it was right in the beginning of our commercial career. So, it's like, do you want the gig or not? Yeah. And so, at the time, we wanted the gig. Also, they really did underplay how much it was going to be used. By the way, Chef America, the Hot Pockets company, sold to Nestle, I think it is, few years ago. For billions of dollars. I think it was $4 billion.
Jeez, bro.
So they nickel and dimed us. I mean, it was a new company back then, but they ended up using the jingle for all those years, sold the company for billions, and we did it as a buyout.
Doesn't that hurt at least a little?
No, it hurt a lot. When we found out that they sold the company for $4 billion with a B, that hurt.
Yeah.
And including the singer, I mean, they used her voice. They ended up paying her a little more years later just out of conscience.
What about the lawsuit the Yahoo guy?
Exactly. She got a milk and cheese guilt.
With the lawsuit guy from Yahoo, you know, that whole thing. And he said it was supposed to be done like just one off or something. And took him to court and it won.
Just remember, if you say no, someone else is going to say yes. So at some points in your career, you got to do something. I mean, you got to stick your neck out
there. Especially in advertising. I mean, when I lived in Chicago when I was doing advertising stuff. And you could, it was like vultures waiting around in the hallway. Yeah. They really were.
Well, especially in Chicago,
yeah. And even as a player, they'd see, you know, I always used to tell people, man, you one mistake, and there was somebody in the hall who said, I could do it without the mistake.
Of course.
Oh, like, it was like that, you know. Well. It's really fun.
Wow.
Really miss it.
Oh, wow. God, I hated that. Yeah.
The Calico demos, geez.
You know what? I will say this. We used to do a lot of network advertising, and this is when we were just starting out, but we used to do demos for a lot of stuff that ended up on CBS. I won't say what ad agency and everything, but we used to do demos for this company, and another composer came to town, and he used to actually go to the ad agency with his keyboard in the car and sit in their office and write demos with them. So they would normally call us for demos, which would take, you know, an afternoon to turn around or whatever, and he started circumventing that process and actually showing up with a keyboard and, like, sitting in the hallway and banging out ideas. So, like, as a producer would walk by, he'd be able to play them something on the piano. I just wanted to kill the guy. That was just so annoying. But that's the mentality.
But you know what? Not much has changed, because I tell you what, as soon as anybody knows that I mix commercial spots, I get demos all the time thrown at me, you know, music, hey. And they just, first of all, they don't know I'm not the one who's going to pick the music for you. You know, every once in a while I'll have an input, but it's mostly the creative guys. But it's just a vicious game out there.
I have better stories from doing jingles in Chicago than I do from making records.
Oh, yeah. What was one of your jingles?
Oh, lots of McDonald's stuff and
jeez.
The Shasta pop stuff I wrote.
Shasta.
Stuff
you did that out of
Wash.
Yeah,
that was you?
Yeah, even the vocoder was me.
No, okay.
Was. And they said, what is this thing? And I said, it's me not being able to sing and wanting that SAG payment.
Right.
Because these people have Mercedes and I got a Toyota. Why is that?
Well, here's what you're
they're singing. I'm going, guess what? See this thing? This with the little sliders on? I sing too.
Well, you know what? That was the, in those days, that was the absolute best lesson I know I ever learned. I'm friends with Suzanne Ciani, who did a ton of jingles back then.
Yeah,
she's awesome. I love her.
Suzanne Ciani.
She taught me early on, I mean, like the early 80s, she said, you got to get your voice on every commercial you do. So, like, the first time we did a Coke commercial, guess who went, and you know what? After, thank you very much. Yeah. You know, for years. That was paying royalties.
Yep.
And she taught me that, and she had done, like, a lot of GE, We Bring Good Things to Life, and a lot of stuff where, and she had gotten her voice on a lot of things.
That was her doing that whole, the singing and stuff on
correct.
There.
She's not really a singer, but she would do a lot of vocal effects. She also did a lot of, she was really cool, because she would do a lot of things that you couldn't tell if it was a synth or a voice.
Mm.
And some of it was vocoder and Buchla stuff, but it was also, like, she was the first to make the sound of pouring a Coke out of a synth. So it was like a bunch of synths strapped together, and so one went pop, and then one went gurgle, 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 and like, blah, 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 blah.
You know, I have to tell you, remember that, this is a long time ago, so we're going to expose our age. Do you remember the Pizza Hut 5 minutes to lunch campaign from, like, where it's like, if you didn't get your pizza in five minutes, you'd have to pay for it?
Yeah.
Jeez, and you remember that the campaign was the pizza hitting the table and went whoosh when it hit the table?
Yeah.
I sat with an Oberheim and the Pizza Hut people for about 4 hours. And you've got a white noise generator and you go, whoosh. You know, that's all that thing that you watch and you go, okay, go, whoosh. And you record it, and you watch it, and you go, "It's good, but."
Yeah.
And I swear to you, I went, whoosh.
Yeah.
And then somebody said, "Let me hear the first one," you know, which of course
it's always the first one.
A good one, you know. So for years, you're haunted by this little royalty check for going.
For 4 hours.
Yeah. Like, but that was the brass ring. You could do really well doing that.
Yeah.
Not so much anymore.
No, I wouldn't know, but
yeah, I do know.
It was great for me then.
Oh yeah,
I'm sure great.
The thing was, it was by committee, which drove me crazy.
Yeah,
it's always having the. I always wanted to give them like little like number cards. So I was like, and it would always be
like in the Olympics,
8882. Then it turns into 2 2 2 2 2 3. You're like, you know, because they go like, I love it. I'm not sure. You know, now that I think about it, I'm not sure.
What I always noticed was there'd be three or four people in the room, and it'd always be one guy who wouldn't say anything. But when it really came down to it, everybody kind of look at him and he'd go, oh, yeah, oh, that's the one. That's the one.
Right. They call him the boss.
Yeah. Well, we all know Richard Marx, right?
Right. Yeah.
You know, his father Dick Marks was like the one of the first jingle houses in America, and certainly the biggest in Chicago at the time. But Dick Marks wrote Snap, Crackle Pop, Rice Krispies, Experiment. I mean, like, that was all Richard's dad.
No kidding. Right?
Wow. And in fact, when I started working, Richard came in and sang on stuff, and he was a little kid, you know. So right. Dick's going to bring his son down, he's going to sing on stuff, and he sang his butt off even then. And there's fantastic stories about that stuff. But one of my favorite ones is how Mr. Wrigley chose his jingles. And he was a little bit of a musician. Have you ever heard this?
No.
Because this is true, as far as I know it, from Dick Marks. He could play a little bit, and he could sing a little bit. So he'd come to the studio to hear it, but what he really wanted was the lead sheet. Mm-hmm. And he'd take the lead sheet home, and he'd play it at home. And if his dog howled, you got the campaign. And that was it. So it was like you could write. It didn't matter. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's when you know that thing. I was doing as a session player for a while, and then I started writing, and then I started producing, and then I had to get out of Chicago. But when a campaign would go around, it would go around. And you'd go from, you know, one session to the next session to the next session. Yeah. And, you know, if it was Wrigley's and they wanted something bouncy, you could see the quarter notes as you were walking. You just knew you were going to be going.
And you were just hoping that dog would howl.
It didn't matter to us. We were going to be on it no matter what.
That's awesome. Well, hey, listen, we're gonna wrap up this first part. But, wow, I don't know if I'm depressed or happy or just full of the giggles from all the great stories. But anyhow.
All I want to know, can I get my Hot Pockets copyright back?
Yeah.
I
want it for you, bro.
It's been 21 years.
All right, so when we come back on the other side, we're going to talk a little bit about mixing and we're going to talk about how to prepare for a mix. So we'll see you on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were basically all getting depressed.
Oh, God.
But I'll tell you what, the best thing about this podcast is some of the stories that we get to hear during the break. And we were talking about client stories. And I tell you, man, it's a great business as long as you don't have to work with clients, you know?
You wouldn't have stories, then.
Exactly. I know. Nothing to talk about.
Yeah, none of us have great stories about working with ourselves.
Yeah.
No, those aren't great stories, trust me.
No, but nothing. I tell you, boy.
I smoked 8 pounds of weed. I couldn't find my way out of it.
Anyhow, we're going to switch gears a little bit and we're going to talk about mixing. And last time we were here, we were talking about what kind of mixer you were. Mouse mixer, fader mixer. Bobby, what kind of mixer are you? Do you mix?
Yeah, a combination, but I prefer doing automation in the computer. I prefer drawing it in than using faders. It's just faster for me.
Right. Mouse mixing. How about, Patrick, do you do any mixing now? I mean, I know you do a lot of... Patrick, this is an audio podcast. Your facial expressions do not come across well.
It's mics. You need better mics.
That was a resounding no.
I mix. Yes, I mix. Yeah. Yes.
And fader mixing, mouse mixing?
Fader mixing, primarily.
Okay. Nice. So get a big lever. I'm just thinking
like the old days.
You know.
Have you ever seen any of those boards from like, you know, the 50s and the 60s and the 40s?
The red.
They're awesome. I mean, some of those big knobs or the big handles.
They went backwards, you know that. The volumes, you know, we push away from the sliders.
That's right. Yeah. You ever work at Atlantic in New York? And they had an MCI console, if you remember MCI at the time. Yeah. But as you came towards you on the faders, they get louder.
Louder, exactly.
Oh, and the first time you worked on that, I'm telling you, man, your head would explode.
Yeah.
It's like the first time driving in England or something.
Yeah, yeah, right.
That actually might be that'd be kind of cool. I'd like to try that.
And you know what? You know why the concept is that the EMI developed, and they said if you want the sound to come closer,
right,
you bring it forward.
That's like organ stops.
Yeah, organ stops. Exactly right. Mm. That's mostly more like where they got the idea from.
So let's talk about, okay, so we've all kind of defined what kind of mixing do you do?
Mostly fading. Fader misting.
Fader mixing.
Sorry, what was that?
Cocktail mixing.
Cocktail. Fader mixing. I can feel it.
Tequila! So now that we've kind of defined, you know, the different kinds of mixing styles and what people like, let's talk a little bit about preparing for a mix. And let's talk a little bit about how you guys prepare for a mix. And I want to start with you, Bobby. If you track and you're working on a project, how do you prepare for a mix when you're going to start rolling into the mix? I mean, do you already have all your comps already done? Do you do
it depends what sort of...
Let's say you're doing a typical music project.
Well, when I was a mixer, I used to sometimes come in and they'd send me the cassette in those days or see a rough of it, and I'd learn the song and then get to the studio and work out what's on the tape. So it depends. If I hadn't recorded it, which lots of times I hadn't, I was just the mixer, then it was a whole different thing. But I'll give you the way that if you record it and then mix it, because that's a little bit more comprehensive, right. Maybe people can learn a little bit more. Basically, clean your tracks up. Make sure you got your tracks nice and clean. For example, I'm talking back in the old days, I'd have like 48 tracks of analog, 224 track tapes, or a couple of Dash machines. So I'd have like a bunch of, you know, 96 audio tracks on tape mostly. And so I'd make sure that it was not going to be a bit real pain in the butt to have multiple instruments on a track, because in those days we were limited with tracks. I'm talking about a limited situation, but you have to think like that. So if you think like that, so essentially in a nutshell, organize your tracks in a fashion such that it will be easy for you to break them out into a console. I'm talking about console mixing into like an EVA, an SSL, or a multi-slider sort of mixer. So to prepare for a mix, I'd always make sure that the source of the stuff is essentially patchable and easy to access and get out into the console. And then I would normally have a box of ideas or tricks. I used to have my own racks, but either way, I'd have a bunch of equipment that I'd sort of like have a patch set up. I mean, a normal setup on my console where everything was always patched in a way that I'd like to work a console. So a massive part of preparation for a mix, like anything, is make sure you mark the console. And I'm talking about a large format console, but make sure you mark it. And it can be on a digital console, of course, or a Pro Tools system. Make sure it's named correctly. Don't be looking at a track audio 1, audio 2, audio 17 and go, I'll remember that. You won't remember it. Mark it down. It's B vocal second verse, then it is B vocal second verse. Write it down. So I would say preparing for a mix, have it organized, because mixing should be a creative process. And if you have to get into the other side of your brain where you have to think, oh, was track 17 the guitar pickup or was it? Right. It becomes a pain and it takes energy. And mixing really drains energy. So if you don't have your energy sorted in a certain way, planned out, you'll wear out really quickly.
That's a great noise.
It is. So preparation one thing, and then have everything up on your console. And again, it works for digital as well, where I have an array of racks, stuff that I have at a chain, and I have everything in buses, and I have all my VCA set up, and I have my sweet spot in the center of the section, in the center of the console, where I can assign it to my center section slider. Mm-hmm. So I can sit in the middle and focus on things. Some consoles, digital consoles, are nice. You can sit in the center and EQ a kick drum off way down the channel. It's important that you organize your mix in a certain way where it's going to be a creative, lovely thing where you actually get into the kitchen, you've got all these mixtures, right. And you chuck them in, you make a pie. You may make seven pies and you're not sure which one you like, but it would be an artistic thing. So that's the way I like to mix, but I like to really prepare first, massively prepare, over-prepare, even down to the point where I used to color code. My input channels would be blue, my output channels would be red, my aux sends would be green. I used to want a specific way. I used to cut the console tape with a razor blade. I was like a military sergeant when it came to that side of it, but the creative side of it, distortion, bad, whatever, audio chains, that's all great, but that part of it. So I would say, prepare well for a mix, organize it. Make sure you organize, and then it's much more fun.
So do you have a regiment that you would always do? Would you always
pretty
do
much
that?
I'd have... When I was a hired mixer, I would go and I didn't know I'd be doing certain bands. I would have basically a rack of stuff that I go, okay, this is cool. I'd have a bunch of stuff. Okay, this is my background vocals patch set. You know, you have harmonized all this sort of junk. And I'd have patches on there that I'd, you know, worked out and kept. And I have my larks and my 480s and all that. I'd have all that stuff ready to go. And I'd know what would work well on this sort of stuff. But of course, it wasn't that generic where I'd say, okay, snare drum, it always has this reverb. Right, but generally, you have big chunks. Only because generally I'd have a day and a half to mix a track and have an A&R guy come and listen to it. So, and I'd have to learn the track as well. So it was a little tough. So you have to be kind of, you have to have big boxes of stuff to stick on things.
And you still do that now with the...
Completely. I use Nuendo now, and I have over 1,000 tracks of stored patches, which is like, you know, a kick drum track, a kick drum with keyed, low frequency, a hip-hop kick drum. I've got, you know, MXR.
I've got chains.
I've got folders with, you know, MXR distortion sent off to an auxiliary send going into a speaker. That's a patch. I've loaded it, save it. Because it doesn't, you know, Apple S is not hard to press.
Right.
You know, that's the digital beauty, you know, that sort of thing. So I have all those sort of things so that I can turn around things quickly. Not because I want to do it quickly, but I do. And I don't want to waste time, but your ears get tired, you get fatigued.
Sure.
You've got a sweet spot in mixing. I think it's about 8 hours. After that, it's like, yeah, this is, I'm not digging this anymore. And when you're getting excited, when you love stuff, you know, when you're jamming, you get a new lick going, you find a couple of chords, you're like, you start dribbling. You can sit there for hours doing that. But when it gets boring, you're like, don't like this anymore. Yeah. And then that's a bummer.
Yeah.
And it's an artistic form. And it's important to remember that mixing is massively artistic. Yeah. If you're doing pop music mixing or... not pop music, any music mixing. So that's one of the things. So in a nutshell, be super prepared, then go absolutely silly.
Rob, what about you? Do you have a regimen that you do before you guys start your mixes?
Actually, some of it is what Bobby was saying. I tend to be sort of hyper-organized with stuff. A lot of times the projects we're doing have a lot of tracks, not by Scott's standard, but for a music standard. You know, it could be hundreds of tracks. I tend to be very organized. The only thing I'd add, because Bobby's mixing more on a console and we're mixing usually on the D control, which is basically just a controller for Pro Tools, make use of your groups and your VCAs, because that's when you're getting organized, that's one of the easiest ways, and it's sort of the digital version of using the same color Sharpie when you're labeling the console. So I know if I have say an orchestra on a track, it could be 48 tracks of orchestra, I'll put it on, you know, I'll have it grouped in VCA'd so that there's basically one orchestra fader, but if you hit the spill button, it spills it out onto 48 faders on the D control. And it's good to organize that way. Even if you're not using a hardware console, if you group your stuff in Pro Tools, it's really nice. It makes it easy to find things. The other thing is, in the old days with the tape machine, you'd have to cross-patch things if they weren't in the order on the tape that you wanted them on the console. With Pro Tools, it's easy to drag your tracks into another order. One thing that I found... and it just goes back to my earliest days with Stevie. I always noticed that the tracks were generally, when I met him, he was using 3M32 track. And so you didn't have to worry about like edge effects and things like that on tape. So all of his tapes had kick on channel 1 and snare top on channel 2 and snare bottom on channel 3 and that kind of thing. And over years doing it that way, I just sort of burned in my brain the order of his tracks. And I still, to this day, always put my tracks in that same order. So even though all of our productions are very different, I know if I'm looking for the bass, it's going to be right after the percussion and before the keys. And so if you kind of come up with your own standards, there's no right or wrong, but as long as you know where to find your own stuff and you have an organization, you'll be able to find your tracks easier on a big production. In the old days, it used to matter where the kick drum was on the tape because different tracks sounded different. You don't have to worry about that anymore.
The edge effect was
right.
But, you know, now just, it's all about being able to find something. That's the whole reason when we've talked about hardware controllers. You know, if you have too many faders, you may not be able to find anything. And if you have one fader or like 16 faders, you know, the track you're looking for is never going to be in front of you and you're going to be paging a lot. To me, the most important thing in a mix is that you're not hampered by trying to find things.
Right.
Views help a lot in Pro Tools
because
I'm dealing with hundreds and hundreds of tracks.
Yeah, how do you?
Yeah, you are the track hog of the century.
How do you, and you know, Scott mixes feature films. How do you prep for a mix? Because I know it's totally different.
Yeah,
from,
you know, I didn't think I was unique in doing a mix right now, and somebody else created the template, and I'm totally lost, and I hate it. And then I realized I have a certain way I work, and I kind of have to work that way. Usually, I like my dialogue on top. Dialogue's king. Got to understand what people are saying. Then I break my futzes down below. Then I bring music. And whether it's six tracks, a lot of times I get 48 tracks.
of music that have to go in. And usually I like the solo instruments first. I always, just the way I think top down, whatever's going to be front has to be on top. Then I do my pads, then my rhythms, right. And then my ear candy below that. And then it's got to come down in the sound design, the sound effects, all of the key sounds that need to stick out. Because I think of it louder, softer. And then so I put all of my things are going to pop, whether they're creatures, weapons, whatever right. The project is. And then as you go down, it gets into pads and BGs and stuff like that. It depends if it's all on one machine or if it's on six.
I was going to ask you that. If you're playing back on six fully loaded Pro Tools rigs or more, how do you keep track of that?
What I do is I categorize it. I'll have, let's say, one machine for dialogue, one for group. I'll have one for, let's say, like Hellboy. Of one creatures, one weapons, one musical sound design, or you know, hitting stingers. I'll have one that is. I actually build it for CG purposes. So what happens is I'll have all of these tracks and CGs changing, computer graphics, and instead of taking the mix and shutting it down at you know $1,300 an hour, that doesn't work for the producers. So what I'll do is I just you know go one of the machines will go offline. We'll update it. I'll put it back online. You know, and the mix just keeps moving because there's so many things to mix in at a given point. Mm-hmm.
But so if you're trying to find a sound, it's the same thing I was talking about.
The reason,
you just pick which
the
machine
reason, I'm known for going wickedly, East Coast term, wickedly wild because it's easily categorized. I can destroy a mixer or I can destroy a mix with 16 tracks. Mm-hmm. If you can condense it and there's no rhyme or reason how you put in it. And I've seen guys do this. It just becomes cumbersome and crazy. I can give somebody 800 tracks, 600 tracks, whatever, and it's so easy. Why? Because it's organized. Because the thing is, when we mix in big consoles, the sound effects section has 500 inputs, you know, and you go, oh my God, that's crazy. No, it's not, because it's all groupers. He's all controlling the mix on 16 to 32 faders.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
And then he spills it out. So then at that point, you go in and you sit there and say, good guy guns, bad guy guns, offstage guns,
right.
Vehicles, skids, and you break it out, and he's just got one, you know, one little fader.
Well, the question I have, when you get those to the stage, those submixes,
right.
they're already finished, or do you have to actually go in and make those submixes?
Well, you mean like pre-dubs?
You know, it depends.
Yeah.
Well, in other words, if you have, you know, 100 inputs on one fader, do you have to go in and mix those?
What I'm doing now, what I did before and what I do now is different. It also depends on if I'm mixing or if I'm having somebody else mix. Is there's something called pre-dubbing. Pre-dubbing originally was, we don't have automation, we have so many faders, and we can't possibly mix these many channels. So you pre-dub them down into more controllable units. I'm kind of getting away from pre-dubs. I'm kind of changing the way I like to work. Dialogue, you need pre-dubs because every couple seconds is a different air tone, and you got to make all the dialogue seem like it's coming from the same time, same place, and smooth it all out. That needs pre-dubs because to watch clients sit through that, you know, they start, like, just shooting themselves in the head. It's worse than watching grass grow. When I design, I'll pre-dub it virtually in Pro Tools. So then this way, you know, some people re-record it is the old way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also they go, oh, hey, we added 2 seconds to the middle of the scene. And now suddenly you got to hold, you don't have the elements, and you've got to build something, got to top it, and you keep adding crap to a mix, which takes away the clarity. Mm-hmm. My thing is how much are we getting rid of most of the time. So this time all I have to do is take out the handle off the end of it, and I got it. Takes me 2 seconds. Very fast on the stage. The whole point is about speed. And making it as easy as possible. So if I do things virtually, what we call virtual pre-dubs,
mm-hmm.
I would just do a lot of that in my room or work with the mixers. It depends if I'm mixing or they're mixing.
How much does it get tweaked when it gets to the stage?
Tweaked a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time it gets to the stage, in my philosophy from the day I started, especially from the sound design standpoint, it's all going to make sense. You put the faders up, because a lot of times we haven't heard the music yet. So let's say, like, we were doing something, you know, Danny Elfman's got his thing going, and I've got, you know, I don't know, a bazillion tracks going. And if you play them all at zero, they all make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, he's got gongs going, and he's got the trumpets going, and we're saying, okay, at this point, now we have to start making decisions, because the emotional element's coming from the trumpets, or this time he's got, like, we had one section
where we went in and we couldn't get anything to cut through anything, including his music. And we're like, this is a car crash. And Guillermo's like, oh, this isn't working. So we literally dissected all the tracks and we found out he's got gongs going, you know, through this. And we're like, get rid of that. What's this? We've got little wood blocks. Get rid of that. Bee Gees. No one's going to hear it. Get rid of that. And we're taking out half the tracks. And all of a sudden, everything's opening. Things are masking. And now you can start actually pushing and pulling and, you know, cutting out frequencies so the other frequencies pop through. I mean, it's a dance. But we spend, we're spending 3 days to do a hot, really good film, 2 to 3 days per 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And, there, you know, you should 10 to 12 hour days, and that doesn't include pre-dubs.
Wow.
So I would say that for 10 minutes, you're probably talking about 4 or 5 days.
But really, the same thing happens when you're doing music mixing, because there's so much that you're getting rid of that you're muting all the time.
Absolutely.
If you're doing it well, just so there's room for everything else. So
it's funny because I'm doing a whole bunch of music mixing coming up, and the big thing is also it has to do with the picture. It's not just close your eyes and listen, let the music sing. Now all of a sudden there's something visually happening. And we've got to figure out the peaks and the valleys of the storytelling, because it's going to go up, it's got to go big, and also we come down. And I love quiet. I love dynamics, because you can't get loud unless you get quiet. Yeah. So, you know, trying to find those peaks and valleys, and you were talking about setups, markers. I mark the hell out of Pro Tools, because that's my guideline going, okay, here you're going to go up, here you're going to go down. And there's little plots. So then when I'm mixing, because I love faders, I can actually play and feel the music.
That's cool. I'm,
you know, and no, we're not going to rise for that occasion.
One other thing I'll say, because the idea of pre-dubs applies to music also. It's in music, it's called comping a vocal, you know, that kind of thing. And when we've done post-mixing, I agree. The thing that's most important to pre-dub is the dialogue, because generally there's a right answer. You know, generally when you're pre-dubbing the dialogue, you're there are a zillion fixes in there that once they're fixed, you don't want to think about again. You know, if you've matched all your room tone and you've gotten out your lip smacks and all that stuff, you sort of have a correct answer. And so there's no reason not to just record it, because you're not going to want to go back usually to the version that is all messy.
Right.
Comping a lead vocal is a little more of an artistic thing, because you might decide we want this ad lib or that ad lib or whatever. But it's still the same basic idea. It's nicer to be able to mix to a vocal that's already been comped. Rather than always imagining, well, I know we're going to clean that up later. It's better to comp the vocal. The beauty of Pro Tools or Nuendo or any of the workstations is you can always go back to the uncomped version if you need to.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But a good thing when you're mixing is not to try to mix to a vocal that has a bunch of problems.
Yeah.
Do those cleanups first.
I think overall is get the problems out of the way in almost any mix.
Yeah.
Then you start becoming creative, the technical creativity.
Patrick, how do you prep for the mix, or how did you prep for the mix back in the day?
I'm just fascinated by the idea of having 800 tracks.
It's a sickness.
That would sort of account for my entire career, about 800 tracks.
How big were some of the tracks and some of the like a prayer? How big was that?
48.
Really?
Wow.
224 track analog machines.
Wow.
Any comping and all that for vocals?
Well, the thing that I'm thinking about is, you know, that for listeners, I'm sure we all relate to this, that the thing of when you first start mixing, it's about turning things up. And as you go along, it's about what you turn down. Mm-hmm. You know, and so you can save a lot of trouble if you start turning things down now, if you're just starting out. So for anybody listening, it's a subtractive process. It's not an additive process. And for me, I'm a slightly unique position in that the records that, and the, it's always been records, or if it's film stuff, I'm handing in a stereo mix. Do you know what I mean? Or,
really?
Or a 5-channel mix or whatever it is. You know what I mean? But I'm just handing in a mix with the channels.
So you're not breaking it into like 6 5.1 stems?
No, I haven't done films recently enough to have it be, you know, broken down that much of it, you know. But one thing that, because of when I started out and how I like to work, is I'd always commit to things. So if there's a guitar effect or there's whatever it is, it's committed to. So that stereo fader, you push it up and it does the job. Mm-hmm. And so It's the same with the drum sound. You don't go, let's just record the drums and put a million mics up, because this is what I've seen people do now with Pro Tools. Like, every mic they own is in the room somewhere, and then you figure out what's... I just did something for somebody, and just they wanted me there to help. And it's like, they recorded the drum tracks, look like, it was like, what is this, you know? And there was, we used three of the mics.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, well, that's useless, and that's useless, and that's useless. And
sure.
So, you know, when you have a 24-track machine or even a 16-track machine and you have a record to make, you commit. So the drums are on two tracks and the bass is on one track. And like you were talking about, you know, working where you start to organize things a certain way. And over the years, you just, I do that same thing. I put things, I group things a certain way where I know where they are. Mm-hmm. And I color code them so that I can just look at it. And you label them so you know where the heck they are. And you do all that stuff. But for me, I usually commit. So it's mostly about kind of sliding the faders up. And it's kind of finished.
I got you.
And even in the engineers I've worked with over the years, I make them commit. They go, what if we don't like this? I go, we're not going to not like it. You know, like, we're here doing this right now. There it is.
Right.
We
right.
love it, right? What we're going to have an issue with is if we don't record this, we're going to have something that we don't know if we like it or not. We're going to go, well, it looks like the meters are about in the same place and the pot's in about the same place. And then the tech comes in and sprays some stuff and suddenly the effect's like five times louder. You go, you know what? Let's start committing to this. It's a kind of an exact, it is an exact sure. science. And mixing should be, it should be an exact science and a real, you should realize what it is you've been working on the whole time. So I've always tried to just build it as it went.
It makes for a better record. It really does.
Yeah, it makes for, you know, everybody's involved in it. You know what you're doing. You play the part. I mean, even
making a commitment, though, it's absolutely massive.
Right. You know what? I'll just mention one thing, because we've talked in the past about how just good mic placement, you know, it's better to have, you know, a good stereo mic set up in the right place in a big, beautiful room than it is to have every single player individually mic'd and then have to figure it out right. later. And I'll just say, I have it on good authority, like Superstition, mm-hmm. the drums on Superstition, yeah. mm-hmm. it's a kick mic and two overheads, mm-hmm. period. That's
that
it.
That was Motown, like,
that's
yeah.
it.
The whole, yeah.
And, you know, try to beat that with your, yeah. you know, 20
I've done,
mic
I've
setup.
I've just done stuff recently, new Toy Matinee stuff, mm-hmm. with 287s with Brian McLeod, one out in front and one over the top.
Mm-hmm. And that's crazy.
It. And it sounds so good.
Mm-hmm. I think
like, it's no stereo. Crazy. Thank you. No yeah. stereo, no nothing, two mm-hmm. mics. And we're, you know, it was kind of at first just playing around, and then we started going, does this ever get any better than this?
You could work a lot harder. Sure.
But that's the old traditional way that everybody did
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it always way. Happening. You know?
And that's when everybody wants to get that sound. They're like, why does the drum sound yeah. so good? It's like, no fading. It's just,
if I'm not mistaken, I could be... If I'm not mistaken, I never heard of the individual miking until the drum machine came in.
No, yeah, we were doing it.
Yeah,
we were
doing it before.
Way before.
Yeah, we were silly.
70s.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And it came, you know, individual mics.
Because you can. I mean, yeah.
No, but I love that whole, I love the community miking, though. I love the kick drum. I just did a drum and bass track where I split a mic between snare and hat because I needed the attack. Top only, not bottom, and an overhead.
But in there's a sort of a festive thing of having a drum set up and a bunch of mics on it, and only four tracks that are available on the tape. Yeah. You push yeah. your mic up and go, move it back 2 feet, compress it till it can't. It's like it feels like it's going to choke to death.
Dig.
And record and leave that one, and then do and make each mic sound good, and then go. That sounds great. Go.
Yeah, that's wicked.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that thing of, you know, I'm being redundant, but there's, you can play with any amount of stuff you want to play with, but commit to it. Mm-hmm. I think the thing in making music and saying, let's just have everything so we can decide later. It's like leaving the paint in the bucket.
Yeah, yeah, no, that paralyzes.
It's like, what is it? What are all these buckets? It's a scene in a mountain.
Yeah.
And there's a river going off here. Where is it? Yeah. Well, it's in the buckets. I swear we're going to put it up. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Well, it may not even be you mixing the stuff later. You know, you want, if you have a vision for what this thing should sound like,
right.
just
I never
record
leave
it
a chance. It's
like, no. It'll only get worse.
You know?
It'll
only get worse. It depends, though, on who is the last say. Because if you have the last say, then you can do that.
The artist.
Yeah.
When Madonna holds up the album cover and says, whose picture is that? wait now. Whose picture is that? Is that your picture? I go, no, that's your picture. She goes, oh, just because it seemed for a second like maybe you thought it was your picture.
Yes. Oh my God.
What a sweet way to put it.
Right up the street.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
So it was great. She should have a great sense of humor about it.
It's a way to end an argument.
I'm writing a book with Ken Scott. It's his memoirs. And Ken Scott, of course, was one of the four Beatle engineers and produced David Bowie, engineered and produced David Bowie and Supertramp and all those
Supertramp.
Great records mm-hmm. from the 70s. 60s and 70s, but that's one of the things that he always talks about, committing. So he told me the evolution of how they started to use multiple microphones at EMI before it was called Abbey Road. And originally it was just two mics. It was a kick mic and an overhead mic. And they needed and it was mostly like for toms at first.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't quite get the projection of the toms, so they started with the mic on the rack tom, and then they started another one, and it just started to happen. But it was still all being tracked, not to a single track. It was the drums along with the bass, or the drums along with the piano, or the drums along with three
it's
instruments
like the
at the same
Marley
time.
Stuff was like that.
So I mean, they committed immediately. To that sound. They either got it or they didn't. And they kept on doing it until they got it. And
makes for a much easier mix later, that's for sure.
Yeah, right.
Which is beautiful.
So it seems to me that, you know, if you're going to start your project and if you have a DAW and you have the ability to have 200 tracks, unless you're mixing a feature film, don't. You know? I mean, I like what Patrick said, you know, commit. Don't be afraid of commitment, you know.
You know, I mean, these days, it's like when the new Logic came out and they had things where they'd say male vocal. Mm-hmm. And you click on it and it puts up a compression chain and a reverb effect. And it's like,
it does.
I got so upset.
Yeah, I
went to this thing with these guys and they wanted to show it to me with the Apple guys. And bless their hearts, they're great guys and they're really, really talented and very bright. But I thought, aren't you sort of eliminating the individual's choice to say, I don't want any compression on this vocal?
Right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But don't forget who they're trying to sell it to.
Exactly.
They're trying to sell it to pros.
I think you should, you know, as little as possible. Do as little as possible. Don't default to believing that what you've heard you need to do. You don't.
Right.
You really don't.
It's like the difference between giving your kids a coloring book where they just have to color in the lines or giving them a pad of blank paper.
Right.
Yeah, and they have to create the drawing.
Like the waves, what is it called? The one?
Yeah,
the one knob.
One knob. Oh, yeah. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I played with it, and I just my head just kind of tilted a little bit, and I went, I kind of get it, but I never use it
because
it's just that flavor. I mean, and when you want it, you know.
But it does sound like perfect for today's music market. One flavor.
Well, look, if you don't have
they don't want to sound different.
You don't really know, and you just turn that one knob, and
there you go,
and also you ooh. It's giving me the reverb, a little compression, a little fatter EQ with one knob. You know?
Well, you could just picture, though, like the guys sitting around in the A&R department saying, well, I think they need more of the knob. That doesn't sound like the knob.
The knob.
I like it.
Hey, really quick, I want to wrap this up, but one thing I wanted to ask you guys, aside from the technical aspect of setting up your tracks and everything, what about the room itself? Any other kind of... regiment that you guys go through, Bobby?
Yeah, definitely. I think the environment's really important, and one of the things that I'll do is make sure that the lights are right, the temperature's right, the clothing I'm wearing is comfortable, the shoes I have are comfortable, all those things. I'll have soft drinks and snacks easily available so I don't have to go running out, all those things. And also, I'll play something that's really, really good before I start my mix, just to get that reference point, knocked in my brain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that because I mix post-production, and I have a long commute. I have about an hour and 15, hour and a half commute. And the first hour I listen to the radio or whatever, but usually the last 15 minutes as I'm coming into Hollywood, I always like to put on some music to kind of just get me in the mood and just to get me, you know, a little bit of energy, but just when you hear good music, and whatever you can define what good music is to you, but it just really, it kind of helps put me in the mood. So that way when I slide into my chair, I'm already, I have a point of reference and ready to go.
Well, this isn't a mood so much. It's more of a reference point. So I know, it's like, I know right, this sounds right, really right. good, so that's what I have to go against. I have to either beat this or I have to be at least as good.
No, that I understand. Yeah. And believe me, but I can't make, you know.
Yeah.
How come everyone else's mix sounds better, though? Have you ever noticed that? Yeah. You're like, man, 6 hours in, you're like, oh, wait, yeah, exactly.
You're
like,
your own.
Man, that sounds pretty good.
What about you, Rob?
Well, the environment's very important. I tend to keep my place all bright and sunny, and I definitely do listen to other people's mixes. It's different if you're always mixing in your own room, because chances are you're familiar with it because you always work there. I will say one little weird thing that a lot of people don't mention, but it's true, is stuff sounds a little different when you wear a hat. And I often wear baseball caps, and there's a difference. And I forget, there was a mastering engineer who actually talked about this in a book once. But little things like that actually make a difference. And if you're making very critical judgments about high end, you'll actually notice. Try it.
Yeah.
Try the baseball cap.
After dinner, definitely. Yeah. Your ears change after dinner. Copious amounts of cocaine, your ears go.
I can
attest to that, but anyway.
That's not dinner, right?
Oh, but it has to be copious amounts. So.
Yeah, a couple of lines don't do you. Like, oh, right.
Scott, what about you? What about the environment? Anything in the environment that's.
Yeah,
that you do any ritual? Any.
Well, like the incense? It depends. If I'm in my room, it's. Yeah, it. Because I'm actually a high energy guy, and
no, really,
and I met a few words, to get me to calm down, and I just, you know, I always dim the lights because I always got a big you know screen in front of me, and my room's dark, pretty much black on purpose, because the only thing I want to see is that image, and I want to get sucked into the story, and get into that mood. But it takes me a while. Usually my best time is after lunch, get a little food in me, I'm relaxed. All of a sudden I got nowhere to go. I've got the rest of the day into the night, you know, just whatever.
Right.
I've already done my business before lunch. And then I just kind of kick back and say, I go home when I feel like I'm done. And then I just keep working. But every dubbing environment's different. And when I'm on the lots, the problem is they all like do a massive buffet of all the things you shouldn't eat. And you sit there and you say, hey, we need to clean some dialogue, and that's going to take about an hour and a half. And it's like, so you're sitting there going, maybe I'll make my fifth trip to that table over there.
To the donut bar. Mixing, not good.
Oh, yeah. Then they sit there and go, ooh, we got coconut pie, we got... and it's all the things you're just like, oh, you're killing me.
But see, that's one of the differences between mixing movies and television and music. Yeah. You eat better. No.
Way better.
Yeah, well, you know, it's
true. There's no catering in my studio.
It's my gosh.
I've never found the donut bar in my studio.
Real quick, Bobby, what about you as far as the room and the environment? Anything?
Same sort of vibe, but I really do like having lights nice. I used to take little lamps and lava lamps and noodly you know, things. I still do my little studio right now. It's like a little sort of quirky. I've got like coloured elephants and stuff all around the place. I just like it. I want to feel like trippy and whatever. You know, just a nice, peaceful vibe where you feel creative. That's it.
Psycho Zen vibe in your place.
Patrick, how about Psycho you? Zen back in the day or even now, how did you have an environment? What was your environment like?
I mean, I like vibe. I think it's important. You know, you can't make... We used to say that without a lava lamp in the room, you don't have talent. Guy Pratt, the bass player, went to there as we were working. There was no lava lamp. And I said, oh, my God, there's no lava lamp. And he went, oh, that's why I don't have any talent. That's great.
It's great.
I do want to say one thing about mixing, though, just quickly.
Sure.
Is that the one thing that I think that I really enjoy about mixing in the box, which I fought and finally went, you know what? I got to stop fighting this. I'm the only one who cares. Is that from the day something starts being a record, I start mixing.
Yeah, right.
So by the last day, we're done.
Yeah.
You mix the whole time. I just mix the whole time.
Right.
You know, so it doesn't matter. A lot of times I've got like one fader and I'm out at my little beach house and I'm like writing a vocal and going, that's better. I'll listen in the car and go, you know, it needs it. I'll just plug it in, and that's better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A little de-essing here, a little, like, comping here, and you just, you're working the whole time until when you're done, you're just done.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and a lot, and oftentimes, because of that, the especially if you're working with an artist, you know, they're loving it, and you go, what if we didn't do anything to this at all but master it? They go, well, were we going to do something to this? Like, you know, because you can do that.
Right.
You couldn't do that before.
Right.
You have to put it up and kind of put some kind of automation that was not really it. And now I have a pile of hard drives and little modular setups all over the place. Yeah. I like to work in a lot of different places.
I don't think a mix is ever done. I think they're all just abandoned.
But you know who mixes like that is Martin. You know, when Martin's writing, he's Paige. Mixed. Yeah.
Yeah,
Martin Page, a good friend. He writes. He's a great songwriter. And as he's writing, he's mixing. And as he's mixing, he's writing. And his songs can evolve based on the mix, and he can bring in parts. And it's just really it's really organic. It's an organic way of
when you're adding a part, you need to hear it in context anyway. So you don't want to be overdubbing on top of something that's hellaciously mal-mixed to begin with.
Right.
You want to hear how the part that you're playing is going to mix in.
And, hey. You know, and technically, I'll just say one thing out there. I've just changed over to native from HD.
Oh, that's, you know what? That's our next podcast on mixing. Forrest.
Yes.
Really quick, what about when you're mixing your own stuff, what kind of environment do you like?
I also care a whole lot about vibe, So, and not only vibe, but space. I noticed that if I feel cluttered, I don't work well. I'm not comfortable. It's almost like it affects my breathing.
Right.
And I also have, not all the time, but I have to have the right kind of incense. And I like Fred Soul's incense because it's like organic resin. And he makes them in his backyard in a bathtub and all that kind of stuff. But, wicked stuff. But the feel of the room is really, really, really important to me.
Cool. What about you, Hez? I know you've been doing some mixing. What have you?
Well, the mixing I've been doing is just all rescue mixes. So,
so you put a lifeguard shirt on.
So I call my therapist after I listen to it twice. But no, I've been working with a songwriter, and he's just given me a number of songs. And you know, he's a songwriter that doesn't know how to mix, and he realizes that, which is good. But you know, I'll get 48 tracks for bass, drums, guitar, and they're all samples from sample libraries.
Oh.
So talk about subtractive. I go in and I just take all of it out. And so what's been really great about it is I've actually...
You can make a click trick.
Well, what I've been doing is I've been rearranging them. And I thought I was going to get nailed for that, but I mentioned it last week. You know, he's really digging it because it's still his song. It's still his melody. It's still his lyrics, but... I just went in and arranged it for him and added new instrumentals and took everything out, and he loves it.
The truth is, if you're not a mixer, give your stuff to someone who is.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's,
right.
I'll say something. If you are a mixer, give it. If you don't, I've done this a couple of times.
I've done this a couple of times where I'm supposed to be a mixer, but I realized I wasn't doing it, just wasn't nailing it. And I've given it to a couple of my buddies to have a stab at this and got much better results. Just out of interest.
So you mean you put your ego on the back burner about it, right?
But
a lot of people don't.
You have to.
Sorry, but one last thing about all that is that as far as vibe, I'm probably not the norm because I'm used to working in really horrible environments. So I've learned how to shut everything out. So my current studio is a complete disaster. And it's full of clutter and everything. But I do put up paintings that I like up on the walls. And that's really important to me because just staring at a monitor all the time, you know, and then closing your eyes to listen to the mix is something that it's fine. But I find if I can look away, and even if I have just headphones on and look at a painting or whatever, I can get a lot of really good inspiration from that.
Yep.
And it pulls things out of me, you know, in order to do the mix or write songs.
You just reminded me of something that I think is something that I do, I know a lot of people don't. I don't have a monitor. When I'm working, there's no monitor between the speakers. I will not have it.
Really?
No, absolutely not. It's not a visual medium. I don't want to know about everybody looking at it. So there's no monitor there.
Interesting. Yeah.
No, I use it to work, and then when it's time to get serious, it's off to the side. It's not in front of us. Nobody's looking at it because people are going, It's like, what are you doing? This is an audio. This is audio.
So wait, so when I was doing this, put it on the side, you turn it off.
I have a monitor so that when I'm working, I can see it.
Right.
And then whenever I'm, you know, when it's just time to listen and push faders around.
I didn't have monitors back in the day either.
It's so off.
That's cool. Exactly. That's pretty cool.
Well, and it's a good point because you'll have, like, if you have a guitar player come in, a lot of times they'll be sitting looking at the Pro Tools screen trying to, like, match the waveform intensity something. And then all of a sudden it's about how it looks, which is the least important thing in the world at that moment.
And then someone's saying that snare is late.
So, right. Yo, yeah.
That gets on my nerves.
That's awesome. That's pretty cool.
You know, Cubase has a feature called ears only, and the monitor goes black.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Yeah.
I didn't know.
It's not a bad idea. I mean, anyone who's doing it, try it. Once you know where things are and you've got your faders and it's coming up on your console what things are.
Right. I don't think I've ever relied on your monitor ever. I'll just rely on the ears.
You know what else? When we have clients, if it's a post thing, a lot of times we'll shut off the faders on the D control for the same reason. The automation is still playing in the background, but we've had clients where if they see a fader go all the way up for some reason in the middle, all of a sudden they're concerned, well, I bet we're clipping there. I bet there's something wrong there. Why'd you do that? So we'll play it back.
That's your part.
Yeah, exactly.
Just put it in Vegas mode.
The most confusing mode.
Well, hey, listen, we're going to be wrapping this up, but one thing I wanted to talk about, you know, for me, when I mix, we're all talking about environments, and my environment pretty much hasn't changed in the last 5 years because I mix in the same room. But it's all about the headspace for me. It's all about how I feel when I'm going to sit down. That's why I was, you know, like I was saying earlier, play some music, get in a good space. But I just, you know, people in general, if you're going to tackle a project and if it's your own project, there's some days where you may not or should not mix because your head is just not in the right space. And I've heard friends' mixes and I've known what they've gone through. But it's not always the case because it also works the other way. Sometimes if you're just despair and you just have a lot of emotion or whatever, you can go into your music and pull stuff out that, you know, you didn't know was there. So, I mean, it's just your headspace is a really, you know, something you should just really pay attention to. How do you feel when you're sitting down? What are you going to do? You know, where are you going to be? You know, are you angry? You know, don't mix angry.
Don't mix angry.
Depends on the kind of music.
It works for me.
You mix angry? No, man. You start slamming those compressors and you start, you know. But really, think about your headspace and think of what you're trying to do. And I think you'll be able to pull some really cool stuff out. Well, hey, listen, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Thank you, brother.
It was awesome. Great stories. I'm going to give Patrick a hand.
Patrick's buying everybody dinner after. That's
right. Patrick's coming back.
I pay for the applause.
Patrick's coming back some more, man. That's too much. There's way too many stories out there that we want to hear. But before we get going, Rob, are you doing anything you can talk about? Do you want to...
Some things I can talk about a bit. As I said on the last one, we're doing some construction and studio improvements / repairs due to a flood. But that's all going well, and I've used this flood as an opportunity to pull a whole bunch of cables through the walls that I regretted not doing 10 years ago when I built the place originally. So it's going to have a whole new kind of connectivity, a new client lounge, which has turned out to be probably the most important thing we're adding to the place. But... it's interesting because the place, I've loved it for 10 years. It's been a great place, but it's nice to have this opportunity, even though it was under terrible circumstances, to
Under waterfall.
Yeah, that was nice. We had that removed. I did that for a little while. That's gone. But creatively, actually, the thing that's going on now, last podcast, Michael Bard was here, and we were working on some Google stuff. I'm happy to say we're going to do some more stuff for Google, and now it's all... it's straight composition work. So a lot of times with Google, we're doing audio post, and this stuff we're doing now is just straight music composition, which is nice because that's where I came from. But so we got a bunch of those things lined up, and I'm trying to get the studio finished as soon as possible because we actually have a bunch of band projects that we need to record, and it's hard to record in a construction site.
I imagine. Patrick, are you working on anything you want to talk about or can't talk about or...
Let's see, I just finished, about a month ago, I finished a Leonard Cohen album.
Wow.
Which was a thrill.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And wrote five songs with Leonard and did it in his house, as I said earlier, with one microphone and a laptop. And it was really fun, dude. And really cool. And right now I'm just working. I'm doing some teaching things and some performance stuff and focusing on that more. I started out, and I might do another Twilight Name project. I started writing some stuff, and I'm excited about that and the possibility of that. And I think that Brian and I, the drummer, and I started working on some things, and I think it's time to go back to psychedelic rock.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I really want to go back to that really like pre-Dark Side of the Moon Floyd stuff.
Yeah.
And we've been playing around with it.
And it's cool.
I'm really having a ball with it, you know. And no one's kind of doing anything like that. Right. And that's no reason to do anything, but I still love it.
Right.
And when I sit at the piano and especially doing concert stuff, where I'm doing improvisational concerts, it's all that. It's just all drifting through different moods.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So why not put it in the context of some songwriting and some lyric writing that, you know, if you have something that matters. I think I'm finding it hard to think of things as a body of work, so why not have it be where it's not a body, it's like two songs. Right. Do you know what I mean? They just happen to be 20 minutes each. I'm serious.
That's really awesome.
That's awesome.
That is awesome. Well, hey, listen, before we move on to you, Bobby, I just want to recommend, last time you were on the podcast, since I have such a long drive home, I listened to Toy Matinee from top to bottom, and you know what? I'm just going to gush on you for a second. That's such an awesome album. Awesome album. And until you listen to it from top to bottom, it's great. So I just want to recommend, guys out there on iTunes, go pick it up. If you don't have it, get it, because it really is a great album. And thank you for some breaking news there.
Yeah.
Bobby, how about you?
What am I up to? I'm up to about 5'6", really. Actually, I've got a couple of projects. The sample library, which I'm still in the middle of it, and not even halfway through it, but basically should be coming up by now. I'm doing... Pagey Martin called me the other day. More than likely, he and I are going to produce another track for Robbie Williams on his hopefully new record. And maybe thinking I might have a little track with him too on the next record. So that's what I'm doing right now. Doing a bit of TV music. Got a couple of 6 cues really on the burner for that too.
Oh, that's great.
Nice, yeah. Just good fun stuff, noise.
Hez, what about you?
Just rescue mixes, you know, just being the lifeguard. And other than that, just writing my own stuff. So... that's about it.
Nice. And
well, a couple of things.
Forrest.
A couple of things. I'm embarrassed to say that I'm working on my own music. That's not the embarrassing part. The embarrassing part is I've realized that I have no problem doing other people's music. But it is hard as hell for me to give myself some love. And that really sucks. One thing that is pretty cool, I love creating though, so that's beautiful. But something else that's pretty cool is I'm actually getting ready to... I'm doing like a Forrest Robinson mini tour. I'm going back to the Southeast in October. I'm doing at my alma mater, University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. I've been asked to come back, and I'm doing 2 days of music workshops. I'm doing doing a couple jazz workshops, and I'm gonna touch. I'm gonna go into, you know, talking about like metal drumming, double bass drumming. A lot of, you know, world drumming, as you guys probably know, I'm way into the African, West African, Afro-Cuban, Celtic, and things like that. And, but then another cool thing is, because I believe in mission and music as a mission, the staff at World Music Mission in Nashville, Tennessee asked me to come and talk about music for one thing. But one other thing that's really cool is they specifically asked me to come and share what it's like to be a believer in the secular world and how have I been blessed to exist in the secular world of music without selling my soul for it, which is... I think it's really cool, because anybody that's in this music thing, it's hard. It's really hard, and I've had my heart broken so many times. But the beautiful thing is I know that my gift is I have a love for music. And if there's no music business, I'm not going to quit playing music.
Right.
And that's something that I'm probably more excited about than anything. So
cool.
Scott, how about you?
Hello.
Sorry,
I heard that comment.
Yeah, I've got. What am I doing? I've got two things, I guess. Right now, I'm mixing. First time I've ever done this: a remake of a video game, which I can't say, but
It's a big game, and they decided to redo the graphics and redo the audio, and we're rescored it and remixing it and re everything in it. So, and they're going to do a re-release, I think, for Christmas. So that's pretty exciting and kind of odd. But the best thing is I get a chance to go to one of the biggest toy stores I can think of for us sound designers. Next week I go to Cape Canaveral to record the launch of the Grail rocket.
Oh,
so, and right now we can be anywhere between 100 feet to, God, which is way too close. I'll blow all my mics. but it's great. I mean, you know, this, we got invited to record a rocket. So we're trying to figure out, okay, what's the SPL? What mics can we grab?
Yeah.
You know, how do we do this? And, you know, and we're going to probably bring out about a dozen mics, all these different recorders, mic pre's, and,
oh, man.
And we got, you know, it's not like they're there for us. We got to be a fly on the wall and set it up quickly and everything to make sure that the mic stands don't jiggle.
Wow.
Or melt. There's that too. But you know, like we're using a DPA 40, was it 40,004? It's got 160 dB.
Wow.
You know, on it, and you know, it's crazy stuff. But I'm just a big kid in a candy store, so I get a chance to see, you know, literally go to 11.
Any 100K mics? Any of the Sanken 100Ks?
No, I've got a Sanken that we're using. I mean, we're trying. You know, it's. To be honest, we really don't know what will work. you know, we're going to have some mics placed at the sky
any
for the launch.
Any binaural mics or any?
Well, we're using a SASP, we're looking at. PZMs will do well because they can handle the pressure. But, you know, and we're using, sound devices and all these different mic-free's. And it'll be quite the rig. And we've got to be able to set it up and tear it down as if we don't exist.
Wow.
So it's fun because it's still thinking outside the box.
Right.
And, you know, hopefully, you know, there's a good chance that 50%, if not more, will be unusable.
Well,
so,
just add an idea. Well,
you get one take, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to say, let's back it up and do it again.
Yes.
I will also just say, if you go back many, many podcasts ago, I just want to give a shout out to Bill Knopf. Who's with NASA? Who's one of the project leads for this project?
Made it all happen, yeah.
And he is he's a good friend of ours, good friend of the podcast, and he was on the podcast. Right. Ann Rao, who's a data specialist, was on the podcast. You can go back; that's a few years ago, but they were talking about data management and all that stuff. But this is a huge thing for Bill because it's his mission. So as he's standing there watching this thing take off, and it's going to be a mission. It's going to actually release two spacecraft that are going to fly around the moon. And take all kinds of measurements and pictures and stuff.
And
it's a big deal.
Yeah, I'm not sure which I'm more excited, the launch or we get to actually record. I'm going to have contact mics on the gantry. So as the gantry pulls away from the rocket, you know, because I've got a couple big sci-fi films coming up that actually I'll be able to use, you know.
No kidding.
Wow. Oh, yeah, it's just like, oh, this could happen.
You can't beat that software.
On the next podcast after when you come back, would you share with us all the details?
And hopefully
details?
I'll have, you know,
hope you have your
same
eyebrows
amount of hair.
Without eyebrows.
Big question. How are you going to capture that fuse being lit? That
the lighter.
Yeah, right.
The lighter. Bobby, how about you?
I'm really busy, and I'm blessed that I'm that busy. In the middle of producing a new album, and I have two television shows that I've been producing. One's in pilot, the other one is actually going forward with the network, and I'm amazed. Well, that's all
that's
I can say.
Nice.
But it's cool, yeah.
Busy is good. Yeah. Busy is always good.
It is.
And Mike?
Just, you know, mixing some commercials, and really it's can't really talk about anything right now, so I'm not going to. And doing a couple of like, kids' projects on my own, which is kind of fun. That's actually kind of fun. We're going
so
into
if we
casting.
Put all if we put all the listeners on an NDA, we can say whatever we want.
Oh, yeah. If everybody, you know, signs an NDA, then...
And let's not forget to mention Jeremy, who needs to cut this one down to about 4 hours. Are you still in there, Jeremy? He's still in there.
Well, hey, listen.
Big thanks to Jeremy.
Yeah, Jeremy.
Big thanks to you, Jeremy. And really quick before we go, a couple pieces of business. Number one, on the next podcast, because I haven't told Bobby yet, but we have a winner for a Bobby Osinski book giveaway that we're going to sign. And so we're going to do that. And we'll probably see if we can do another book giveaway.
Sure, right? We can do that.
Yeah, when the recording Engineer's Handbook. What do you think?
Yeah, sure.
Whatever. So that'll be the next. And let me tell you, those are going to be those are gems. All right. So especially signed by Bobby.
Well, we'll all sign it.
Okay. if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also catch us on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/audionowcast. And before we go, once again, I wanted to mention that you can pick up a Toy Matinee on iTunes. I just looked it up, and yes, it is there. And also, you can get I forgot to mention Third Matinee too, which is another great album. It's different, but it's really good, and they're both really great listens. For myself and all the guys, I just want to thank you guys for listening. And really, you know, we're getting some great numbers on the download, so you guys are talking about it because we have no budget to market this show. So I know you guys are talking about it, so I really appreciate that. And there's been some really good feedback coming back from the on the Facebook page, and just from some of the emails that have come into me personally. And you guys are awesome. You're kind. Thank you very much, and we'll catch you next time.
To the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.